This is Ralph Ferrara, and I'm delighted today to be at the offices of Hills & Stern at 1219 Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., with Roderick Hills, who served as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission from 1975 to 1977. And we're in Mr. Hills' office today to meet with him in connection with a project underway by the Securities and Exchange Commission's Historical Society to develop oral histories of the SEC, Rod, that can be preserved and entertain and enlighten the SEC families in the years to come. Thank you very much for inviting us to your office today to spend some time with you.
Delighted to be here.
Rod, what I think the Historical Society would be most interested in is your recollections about the high points of your tenure as chairman of the SEC. I'm pleased to say that at the time I served on your staff in the office of the chairman, so I think I have some of my own recollections that I'd like to prod you over. But before doing that, I think it'd be interesting to all who listen to this tape or read a transcript of it to learn about your prior history with the Ford administration before joining the SEC, and then how it came to pass that you became the commission's chairman in 1975.
I came to Washington by accident, having been asked originally by Elliot Richardson to be Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, a job that I was in which I was interested. But before I could get myself together, he quit to become Attorney General because of the indictment of the former Attorney General, and found my wife on my resume and hired my wife to be Assistant Attorney General. And we wandered back to Washington out of that. During the last months of the Nixon administration, a number of things happened. For one thing, Ray Garrett was asked to be chairman of the SEC. Ray actually was a close friend of mine. He, for 5 years, had been on the board of the American Bar Foundation Research Committee, along with Lloyd Cutler, Oscar Uthausen, Ed Levy. I think I said Lloyd Cutler. And so for 4 or 5 years, we've been studying the evolution of law firms. Ray Garrett turned the job down. His wife was ill. He didn't want to take the job. And Peter, the last name in a second, from the White House, asked me if I would like to have my name submitted as chairman of the SEC. This was back in 1974. I said no. I didn't really think that that was...
That Pete Peterson?
No. Dylan Reed and Peter Flanagan. Mm-hmm. And I said I didn't think that was the right thing for me to do right then in life. And particularly my wife in the Justice Department, I thought SEC and Justice didn't make a lot of sense. So I went out to Chicago and talked to Ray Garrett. And Ray's concern was that because of his wife's illness, he may not be able to serve on a full term. And anyway, as a result of that, both he and Al Summers came to the commission. And the implication, and to which the Nixon White House conceded, was that if Al had to leave in a hurry, if Ray had to leave in a hurry, Al would replace him as chairman. So anyway, time went by, and then they created this Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And I was asked if I'd be interested in that job, and I wasn't at all interested in that job. And I gave him some suggestions, and instead of my suggestions, I hired a friend of mine from California, Bill Bagley, with whom I had been Young Republican many years ago, and a moderate wing of my party. So I was involved, sort of, in those early days. I almost became Undersecretary of Labor with John Dunlap, with whom I taught at Harvard, but the day or so after I kind of agreed to do that, my wife became Secretary of FUD, and that didn't work anymore. So I was really kind of wandering around loose when my wife's swearing-in ceremony came to HUD.
Now, HUD being the Housing Urban Development Department?
Right. And as life has itself, the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Rockefeller, came up to me during the signing ceremonies in the Red Room, a pre-ceremony. My four little kids, my wife, the President of the United States, and the Vice President came up and said that his lawyer, his good friend and lawyer, Oscar Uthausen, had spoken to him about my interest in regulatory reform, and which I'd done some bit of teaching at Harvard back in the late 60s. And he and the President would like me to reconsider the job of office, to counsel the President, which is a job which I sort of but I wasn't terribly excited about it. And he said if I were willing to take that job, that they would cause me to be kind of in charge of regulatory reform, because Oscar thought that was something I liked to do. And in the excitement of my wife's inauguration as chairman of FIDA with the kids up in the state and everything, I all of a sudden became council president, the ID being regulatory reform. And in that process, we did a lot of things. We brought, for example, all the regulatory agencies to the East Room of the White House, where the President of the United States explained to each of the agencies, including the SEC. I remember I was sitting right across the table from Ray Garrett with the heads of all the agencies, and we all got caught up in the fury of it. I think we did some good things during that period of time. And fortunately, the whole period was overshadowed by the fact that the Church Committee, Senator Church, was investigating the CIA. And so I was nominally most associated with the investigation of whether the CIA had assassinated a whole bunch of foreign leaders. And a lot of things that came in that process. Ralph, you reminded me the time that we were dealt with the Arab boycott of Jewish investment banking firms on Wall Street.
That was the first time I came into contact with you as the SEC's representative to the Arab League boycott task force that you headed out of the White House.
And that was a good time. Bill Simon, you remember, the Secretary of Treasury, he was as curious as was the President and as was I about the fact that major investment banks like Goldman Sachs and others were being boycotted. And the President of the United States wanted to make sure that the world understood that we would not tolerate that. In any event, Ray Garrett did leave because of his wife's illness. And I was given the assignment of finding a new chairman. There were several wonderful candidates, Al Summer being number one, Ken Bialkin was another one. For various political reasons, really not Republican reasons, conflicts in the Democratic Party, conflicts with Democrats and Republicans, I failed to get somebody. It happened that I went out to California with the President with Alan Greenspan on a trip, and when I came back, a lot of people felt that I should take the job. And it happened during the time that my wife was being bandied about as being either a candidate for the Supreme Court or maybe even a vice presidential candidate, so I thought I should get the Dickens out of the White House, and since I was stuck in Washington for a while, frankly, I took the job, largely because Alan Greenspan felt that it was a time for regulatory reform. You'll recall that on May 1st of 1975, the White House deregulated the commission rates. And while Ray Garrett and the commission deserves all the credit for that, the fact is that President Ford and Alan Greenspan were strong supporters of that. And I had occasion during that period to talk to Wall Street about the fact that this was something the President of the United States really thought was important. I got to the SEC with the notion that we would pursue a regulatory reform agenda. We would make sure that commission rates stayed unfixed, that we would broaden the experiment with options trading, and that we would try to bring economic analysis to the SEC. When I met you, Ralph, and we formed a relationship that I cherish to this day. So I came to SEC really with the interest of dealing with the economic regulation of the securities industry. It was kind of an outgrowth of the fact that I taught, of course, in political economics at John Dunlop at Harvard in 1969.
Now, Rod, when you arrived, you inherited a staff that Ray Garrett had built of senior advisors, but there were some... It turned out to be nearly epic figures in that group, including Stanley Sportman, who was your enforcement director. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about how you developed your relationship with Gallup.
Well, Stanley is a special person, isn't he? He is just terrific. I'm not sure. I think it's probably time for Stanley and I to have a lunch to reflect upon those days, because they were, in some respects, chaotic. Having come to the SEC to deal with economic deregulation, I found myself, as I had in the White House, confronted with a form of corruption. And in the White House, we found the corruption of some aspects of the CIA. And all of a sudden, in the SEC, I found myself dealing with the so-called Lockheed-type foreign corrupt practice cases. We call them the What was the term you used? Inappropriate for payment status. Hey, that we have
foreign payment.
Foreign payment scandal. And all of a sudden we were there. And Stanley, with his wonderful integrity and wonderful style, was pushing these cases. And I think he was kind of suspicious of this Republican from California. I hope that he thinks, as I do, that we were a great team, along with you, Ralph, and the other staff people, in dealing with more than 400 American companies that were compelled to disclose that they made inappropriate payments to foreign officials. And there's a wide variety. I mean, there was a terrible case of tens of millions of dollars paid to government officials for business. And there were some things that were now called euphemistically grease payments, things that all of us would do to protect the integrity of corporate property, shareholders' property. But we lived for a long time on this.
Perhaps a little bit later in this interview, we'll return to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that you had a role in developing, but I'd like to stick with the staff issue for a minute, because as I recall it, Sandy Burton was still the chief accountant of the SEC at that time, another great figure, and perhaps you could tell us a bit about your recollection of Sandy Burton.
Sandy convinced me very early that the SEC needed a strong, forceful chief accountant. Unfortunately, Sandy and I had disagreement on the issue that Sandy was most interested in, and that was his desire to bring the cost of inflation to earnings per share. And I just come from running a strange conglomerate, a public corporation, formerly Public Pictures. Mm-hmm. And I was quite convinced that you could not reduce the problems of inflation to earnings per share. So while we had a terrific relationship, I think personally, for that period we were together, we really had this disagreement upon how to deal with that one economy issue.
You also had on your staff, as I recall it, the current chairman of the SEC, Harvey Pitt, who I believe at the time served as your general counsel. And we certainly would be remiss if we didn't talk about those days and Harvey's role as general counsel of the agency.
Well, Harvey was, and is of course, a very competent lawyer, dedicated to the work, quite intense about the work. I think that the overall team was terrific. I think that you, Ralph, the other people on our staff,
Bob Kraft
and David Boyd, certainly Richard Zecker we brought in as the first chief economist the SEC ever had.
You should take some pride in that. It is the first chief economist.
And Susan Peters, who was his deputy.
And she went on to be a member of the Federal Reserve Board.
Well, this was an important time. You may recall that we brought in Fisher Black and Myron Scholes to talk with the staff. And I remember watching the discussions between market regulation and enforcement with people like Fisher Black and Myron Scholes. And maybe you remember that we brought in George Stigler one Friday afternoon. And at the time, I was thinking that most of people thought I was absolutely a mess and bring it in. But I do believe that over that period of time, many of the staff recognized that there were other disciplines besides the law to deal with market regulation. The curious thing is that I had a big fight with Jim Lynn, who was head of OMB, about hiring a chief economist. But Lynn didn't think that was a great idea. I forget the. I over the years, I've grown fond of saying I traded in three lawyers and the two automatic typewriters to go to chief economist. But I did have to negotiate the budget, and we did have some surpluses under this. So Dick Zecker was the first chief economist, and Susan Peters was his deputy, and I think that was a. When you put all that together, I think that I'm pleased with that.
Did you find that it was a tumultuous time to mingle together, perhaps for the first time in the Commission's history, the thinking of free market economists and the thinking of regulatory and enforcement lawyers?
Oh, I think so. I suspect that I still suffered from people that from that era that thought that was an unnatural alliance, and that as many times the bridging was a little tense at the time. But I'm pleased with it. You may recall that we really began serious exploration of the options trading those days. And one of the last things we were able to accomplish was finally the approval of some put options. There were some experiments in call options. So we had this wonderful idea that you could have call options, but the idea of put options was anathema, the idea that you could sell somehow you could get the stock market going down. I recall one day, since I think it was Fisher Black, at the commission hearing, where commission hearing with one of my treasures of colleagues, Irv Pollack, who, by the way, his office is on this floor, next door. Irv was upset at the notion of the put options and the idea that he could bet on this stuff. I thought that was terrible, bet on the stock going down. I remember Fisher saying quietly, well, he said, if you don't like it, you can pass the rules saying the stock can't go down. And I remember Irv laughing and kind of reaching over and said, well, I got the point. And I think we did move on, importantly. It was an important beginning at that time.
So we're talking about interactions with staff. I mean, look, we're talking about history. And there are some parts of history that are going to be easy to talk about and some parts of history that may not be so easy to talk about. And I'd like to direct your attention to a subject that may be less easy to discuss, and that is your recollections of a time at the SEC when these very powerful division directors, some of whom you've described today, but all of whom were men and women of great stature at the time, there was a time when perhaps they shared a view of the SEC collectively that perhaps wasn't that of the commission itself, and a tension that may have existed between the commissioners trying to do their job as the heads of the agency and the staff trying to set forth an agenda that might not be consistent with it. Do you have recollections of that during that era, or a change in that during that era?
I do, but I would frame the question somewhat differently. Mm-hmm. While I've been around the corporate world, and while I'd managed many parts of Wall Street and seen many problems, I could not claim to be a student of the commission when I got there, although several prior people, Frank Lee in particular, an old friend of mine, a wonderful former commissioner, and one of my former law clerks, co-clerks, Wayne Lyman, had been executive assistant to Danny Cohen, so I followed the commission in a certain fashion, but I wasn't steeped in the lore of the commission. So I came with a strange notion that the job of a chairman, especially someone with my background, was simply to challenge people to make sure they knew what the commission should do. It was part of President Ford's tenure. It was very likely to be a short tenure. And so it seemed to me the best thing to do was to challenge those things. And not because I thought they were wrong, but because I thought they deserved challenge. So I can't discriminate today between the views of my fellow commissioners as to what they thought. Jai Evans was a fine economist. Irv Pollack was a fine enforcer. Phil Lumis was a fine lawyer. Al Summers, who had every right to be chairman and really should have been the chairman of the SEC. And so we were all kind of in the milieu of a transition. We were going from a time of fixed commissions and a static market to a time of enormous growth of mutual funds and pension funds. It was all mixed up. It was all mixed up. I felt that market rate, we had a division called Division of Investment Management Regulation. Mm-hmm. And I tried very hard with that division to kind of loosen it up. And to my knowledge, the only thing I accomplished was to take the word regulation out of the division title. But people thought about it. People thought about it. And it was a period of which I think there was good humor. I look back at it and think that there was not a whole lot of business. But it was kind of a transition. The stock markets, the options market.
There are some who see your tenure not only as a time of transition, but as a time when the commission itself seized back the agenda of the agency from its senior staff and returned more to the model of the earlier commissions in its earlier days, when the real experts of the agency and those who set the agenda for the agency, the policy for the agency, were the commissioners themselves that the staff had implemented. And I think this era that you call as one of transition is one that perhaps you initiated and continued for several chairmen thereafter.
Well, I think I came at a time that made it possible. I do recall with some affection, there was a lawsuit that you may remember, or a case you may remember, that the commission, the commission staff, wished to bring against most of the houses on Wall Street about, I suppose I would call it, characterize it as a lot of kickbacks with fund managers. It was a potentially a huge case. There were some obvious abuses. And the Corson division had a huge case that they wanted to bring. Maybe you remember this. And I was new to the commission, and I asked Stanley to bring the case before the commission. was present the evidence. And Sam was really quite frustrated at the outset. But you may recall we sat day after day after day with Stanley and his staff presenting the case against the various firms. And there was some very good cases against some firms and some others. I don't recall any division among the commissioners. But I do recall that we narrowed the case quite dramatically. And I remember with some affection the Stanley came to me afterwards and said that was a good exercise, that we had really created a certain discipline. And you may recall, as is still the case, that the authority of the SEC's enforcement division to threaten the case was probably more important than bringing the case. And I was concerned at the time that it was too easy for a righteous and decent enforcement person to say to somebody, we're going to recommend this case to the commission unless you settle. And I was concerned that you could have a disparate enforcement activities if you didn't pull it back. So I do think that we created a better relationship between enforcement and between the commission. I also think that we made the general counsel's office more important during that period of time. But we asked the general counsel's office to play a role before we, I think a stronger role before we brought a case. And I recall you and Harvey having long times discussions about whether this case was the right one to be brought or not. And I don't recall, although you may, that there was great dissension. I don't recall that the enforcement division was upset sometimes when we didn't bring a case. I recall it was some kindness.
And I also recall the role that you and the commission played, even in the general counsel's office, of helping shape the position that the agency would take as amicus in important cases in the Court of Appeals. And one case I do recall where you brought special expertise to the agency was the International Brotherhood of Teamsters case, where the commission was attempting to take a view in that case with respect to the application of the federal security statutes to the topic at suit in the Daniel case, as it was called at the time. And I think that your insights in that case were of particular importance in the agency coming to the right conclusion.
Well, Chris, the agency and I parted ways in that case. I recall that with some sadness. It was near the end. I can't recall whether the Court had just been defeated. I think it was defeated shortly thereafter by the President Pratt. But I recall also that the General Counsel and I had a quite an important disagreement on that. I thought that that it was too late. I thought that the statute itself did not permit it, but I also thought that for too many years the relationship between union co-managed pension funds and the Department of Labor, it was too late for the SEC to assert itself. As you may recall, that was, to my knowledge, it was the only time up then that one member of the commission dissented from the decision of the commission.
I do recall that it was a debate, but a debate done on very principled terms, and it was the first time that we had a chairman of the SEC who could really bring substantive denominator to a different area of the law where we were trying to show an SEC footprint as amicus. And I recall it being a lively but very principled discussion.
I think it was. I think it was constructive.
Let me move, though, from there, now that we've talked a bit about the staff when you arrived and during your tenure, and shift to another important area for the SEC chair, and that is to maintain relationships with Capitol Hill. And perhaps you could recall for us some of the personae that you had to deal with there. I have in particular in mind Senator Foxmeyer, who was a very active reformer in his own right at that time.
Chairman Foxmeyer was something. He voted against my confirmation as chairman, as a member of the commission. And he voted against my wife's confirmation as Secretary of Cut. But during the period that I was there, I think we became allies. He was an interesting man. He was interested in the spotlight, his Golden Fleece Awards and all that. But he listened. He certainly listened during the period of the foreign corrupt cases. You may recall, Ralph, that there was a great push in Congress to pass a federal chartering law that Ralph Nader and Mark Green had touted in a book called The Taming the Corporate Tiger. And the idea was to take all major corporations and force them to be chartered by the federal government and be heavily regulated. I thought that was a mistake, and basically I thought that the commission, the enforcement division, market regulation, corporate finance, had dealt quite effectively with the foreign corrupt practice cases. We have caused not only the New York Stock Exchange to require independent audit committees for the first time that audit committees were mandated, but at the staff's suggestion, we required for the first time there be internal controls. And you may recall we went over to see ODCEP, the Executive Committee of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and we said to them, look, we've got these independent audit committees now, and we're about to require internal controls. We would like you to create a new auditing standard. A new auditing standard would require your people to bring anything of questionable nature to the attention of people independent of the province. That's an interesting axis which really began, in my mind, corporate governance as we know it today.
So, well, we're going to get into the corporate governance.
But out of that, Proxmire, who was a great supporter of the Taming of the Tigers, the corporate chartering, the federal chartering of corporations, Prox listened to us, and came on our side. And I think at the end, he was nice enough to call me before his committee shortly after everybody had left. I think you were the only person left who would help me pack my books. And my last appearance before the Senate Finance Committee was to follow Mike Blumenthal. And Prox was nice enough to, before that started, to pay his respects to me. And so he said he missed the opportunity to apologize to my wife for voting against her, but he wanted to tell us that he both appreciated our government service. So.
Very interesting.
He's an interesting guy.
It's very interesting. You recall correctly the federal chartering proposals of the Nader group, and you said that you thought that they were perhaps a mistake. As you know, in 1934, there was a pact, in essence, drawn between the federal government and the states where the SEC, the new agency, would force transparency from public corporations, called disclosure in the 34 Act, and the states would retain the authority to set normative standards of conduct for corporate directors. Federal chartering, as you correctly observed, would have changed that balance. You thought it was a mistake then. We now have just seen the passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, where the United States Congress has, in essence, federalized normative standards for conduct for corporate directors. And I'm curious whether or not your reservation about the wisdom of federal chartering in the mid-1970s raises similar concerns with respect to the wisdom of setting federal normative standards of conduct for corporate officials under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act today.
Well, I think it's a danger, but we should live through the prism of our own experiences, and I prefer to look at it as having the Congress of the United States telling the audit committees of the world. Back in 1976, the New York Stock Exchange said that audit committee should be responsible for certain problems, and by God, we mean it, we should do it. So I see it as federalizing what the New York Stock Exchange tried to do before. Now, it's a danger because we're getting the minutiae. I mean, right now, the SEC has proposed really quite precise rules as to who can be on an audit committee. And more importantly, they found this term financial expert. If the rules go forward as they have been proposed, it will really tell most companies in America they got to get an accountant, CPA, to be on their board. The idea that a guy that's been a treasurer or some man or woman has been a controller, a very precise kind of a rule checking concept. That if you have this title, you can be a financial expert, but what you've done and what you suffered is not relevant. That's the danger of regulation, as distinguished from transparency. So yes, there's a great danger. And I'm very hopeful the SEC will pull back from that and put the responsibility on the boards of directors who will say that the financial expert on their board is so-and-so because he or she has got the following experiences. If we pull back to regulation, we'll say that a person with this precise title can be and this person cannot be, then we will see the worst of what would have been the federal chartering back in those days.
Well, you've given me an interesting transition to our next topic. I am not justified to identify what your greatest achievement was at the SEC. Perhaps you and history will be the judge of that. But certainly from this interviewer's point of view, you are Mr. Corporate Governance and the person who deserves the birthing rights to the SEC's continuing efforts to bring more rigorous governance to public corporations. And I think we would be remiss in this interview not to spend a good deal of time reestablishing for all who listen to this tape or read his transcripts of years how the SEC got so dramatically into the business of restructuring the corporate boardrooms and bringing new rigor to what corporate directors in those boardrooms would do. And I think it all began with your effort and initiative to create or to initiate independent audit committees on the boards of public companies. And perhaps we could start a bit with your views on that topic and then move into how you came to cajole, if I could use that verb, it may be too weak, Mill Batten to be your ally.
Well, it's a nice story. I've come back. We started a law firm 40 years ago, and we required ourselves to take sabbaticals. I've been teaching for a year at Harvard. Came back and found myself accidentally chairing a Fortune 500 company, Republic, in California, which had just terrible problems. Just they've written off, my God, the accounting problems have been near the ones of the day. Now, it was only $80 million in those days, but that would be in terms of today's economy. I can't tell you, but it was a lot. The entire board had quit. I needed to structure a new board. I was asked by the Bank of America. I was told by the Bank of America that I'd been elected as a director. And I sat back trying to figure out what the W do about a company this size with all these accounting problems. It happened that some years earlier, I'd become the vice chairman of the board of trustees of Fairmont Colleges. And as you may know, Peter Drucker, a man who was famous then and famous now for his stories on corporate America, became a complicated acquaintance of mine. He'd written this great book about General Motors in the 30s. And in that book, General Motors, they had described the General Motors Audit Committee, which was, in many respects, the template for independent audit committees. It wasn't entirely what we have today, but the basic thing was General Motors wanted independent directors. And they had one. So I called Leonard Lyman, who I knew as an executive assistant at Vancouver. I said, Lenny, have you ever heard about audit committees? He said, yeah. And so the New York Stock Exchange had mentioned it a couple times. So I said, Lenny, I've got to form a new board, and I've got about 3 days to do it. Would you be willing to come on our board and be chairman of this audit committee? And he said he would. And so we had an independent audit committee, a public corporation, in 1971. And it worked fine. And so when I got to the SEC, and Sammy Sporkin, to his credit, and I think he played a role in it, had begun these investigations, and had begun asking the companies to do some of their own investigations because we didn't have enough staff at the SEC to investigate all these companies. Someplace along the line, I don't want to take more credit than due, but someplace along the line, we began calling them audit committees. I'll take some credit, but I think that the term came out of what we were doing. And it was then that this idea of the federal chartering came about. And I know I talked to you about it. And I said, well, why don't we, the New York Stock Exchange on two or three occasions has recommended that member companies have audit committees. Why did I go up and ask them? So I went up.
Oh, wait a minute now. I think, let me take you a little out of that history.
Okay.
As I recall it, your first instinct was to ask your staff, myself and your general counsel, if the SEC had the authority to mandate that public companies have audit committees.
Yes, I recall that. I recall that, but I have to confess something. I actually hope that we didn't.
And there, it was ambiguous at the time, if you recall.
It was ambiguous.
And then you come up with this wonderful idea.
Well, it was ambiguous. And if you recall the letter I finally wrote, anyway, I called Mill Batten. Actually, it came out Jim Needham was still chairman of the SEC, of the New York Stock Exchange. And I had regular contact with Jim. He was not a favorite in those days. But I went to talk to him about this problem. And Jim rather grumpily said that if we proposed it to him, he would not necessarily reject it. I think that's a fair characterization. He was not enthusiastic about it. And in the next few weeks, he was no longer chairman of Mill Batten, who had been the CEO of JCPenney, became the New York Stock Exchange chairman. I didn't know Mill, but I knew him by reputation. I
He was the first corporate executive, I think, to be chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, was he not?
Depends on what you think of Mr. Kennedy.
Well said.
In any event, I went up to see him, though. And I chatted with him, as you and I were chatting, and I explained to him this law was about to be passed, and what do you think? And it was just terrific. He was terrific on two things. He was big on options. He thought I should pursue options. He said, you know, at JCPenney, we always hedged cotton. And so options is another form of hedging. And he said, I think it's a great idea, and I'm with you. And so I said, no, I'd like to write you an open letter with your permission. I came back and we talked to the members of the commission, and the members of the commission agreed with me. And we wrote an open letter, which I still have a copy, to Mill, suggesting that he might wish to consider it. And in that letter, we said, we do not have the authority to require you to. I'll probably hedge it by saying, I do not think that we have the authority to require you to. Would you consider it?
Well, you may recall that what was ambiguous at the time was whether the commission had the authority to require public corporations to do it, but I think you were of the view, as I recall it, that we may have had the ability and the authority to require the New York Stock Exchange to have as a condition of listing that public corporations have listings.
Nonetheless, I think my letter said that I question our ability to do that.
All right.
Because it seemed to me it was important that they did it voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
Because once we did it, then we would have the responsibility, as you might have said earlier, federalizing it. So in any event, whatever the result was, Mill responded openly. He said he would do it. And then there was a tremendous uproar. My Lord, is my fault. I mean, the chairman of Johnson & Johnson, I was trying to find that telegram that he sent all of us, saying that he and all these companies would leave the New York Stock Exchange if we required it. And the board of the New York Stock Exchange was having trouble. Bill Batten said that, probably you may recall this, said, would you please come up and sit in on one of our board meetings and talk about it? And I called Chairman Proxmire to say that I'd been invited to attend the meeting of the New York Stock Exchange Board of Governors. It'd be a private meeting. I would like him to know that I was planning to do that, and what do you think about it? And he asked what the subject was. I told him, he said, you know, do it. We'll fight for it. And it was a wonderful meeting. I can't pull the names up, but the then chairman of General Motors, and Juanita Kreps, who later became secretary of, was she secretary of commerce in the Picard administration? She was on the board. And we had a wonderful fight at the board, and I was asked to leave, and Mill called the next day or so, and the board had agreed by majority vote to go forward. It was interesting.
Well, this is the seedling from which this mighty governance oak has now grown.
But you may remember, of course you remember, that at the same time we said we would require internal controls. There was some question as to whether we would do that.
Yeah.
And we did. We largely had them. We said you must have internal controls.
Let me switch, since we've got that topic covered at least a bit, I'd like to switch to the Commission's voluntary disclosure program that led to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act passage and your role in that, which was, I think, critical.
Well, I wasn't terribly supportive of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I thought that I didn't like the idea of criminalizing it. I loved the idea of forcing and mandating disclosure. And that part of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that validated our requirement for internal controls was important. But when you thought about, when you think about the, my memory is 412 cases, but whatever the number was, that one company had given $20 million to bribe the prime minister of an important company to sell airplanes. Others had passed $40,000 or $50,000 to protect corporate property. And the idea that you could say that one was criminal and one was not struck me as difficult. So, yes, I think we were instrumental in pushing it forward, but I have to confess that I was not in favor of the criminalization.
But you were, I think, the champion of the voluntary disclosure program.
Absolutely.
That, as I recall it, was the first time the commission basically had offered amnesty to any public corporation that had engaged in this type of misconduct, that is corrupt payments, that would do an internal investigation and report its results freely to the agency.
It was a limited amnesty, as you recall. It was if you'll do the investigation, if we think it was honest and independent, we will undoubtedly accept your results, and we will deal with it in an appropriate fashion. It did not mean that we couldn't take action against the individual, but we would abstain from trying to punish the company. And you say to the company, come in, show us what you got, and we'll deal with it.
I can recall.
It was close to amnesty, but it wasn't terms.
I can recall that getting it as far as you did was a great challenge, because there were those on the staff, Al Levinson, I remember in particular, who were very much against any level of amnesty, because the commission had never done that before. And you championed the notion that if you were going to have people voluntarily do this internal house cleaning, which the SEC could never do on its own, there had to be some incentive for them to do it.
That was a combination of you and others on the staff. That was the wise thing to do. I think Stanley was not opposed to this, I recall. I don't recall specifically, but I don't recall Stanley and I ever having a major fight on major bonuses.
I don't think so. I think, as I recall, Alan Levinson had his reservations about it, but I'm not sure that Ford can do. Well, this brings me to yet another chapter of your tenure, where you brought more openness and transparency to the SEC itself by organizing an American assembly at the agency on the topic of corporate governance. And perhaps you could tell us all what an American assembly is and the model that he follows, and how we brought interdisciplinary thinking, or you did, to the SEC through that vehicle.
Well, we had we were about to leave. Mr. Carter had defeated Mr. Ford. It was in the fall of 76. And I was sad because there was so much to be thought about and so much to do. And I wanted to kind of pull together what I thought were the critical issues facing the commission. So I stole from Columbia University this concept of the American Assembly. And with their permission and your help, we conducted an American Assembly on the critical issues before the SEC, corporate governance being the single most prominent one. Accounting, as you recall, is part of it also. The American Assembly, which was started by President Eisenhower back when he was President of Columbia, was basically the idea to pick a subject and you try to get 60 of those 60 people in the world that are most likely to influence that subject and pull them together in groups of 20 each, divide them up with kind of like Noah's Ark, three lawyers, three bankers, three insurance people, three whoever. Get a good group leader, get a good rapporteur, and give each of the groups the same issues to consider, and then try to get a consensus out of the group. And we did that. Corporate governance, as you say, was a major part of that. And we did that, as I recall, in January or February of 77. We had an extraordinary group of people that came down to that. I've been told by the people in the American Assembly who've seen the list that in the, 50 years of the American Assembly, they'd never had a group quite so distinguished to discuss it. And I thought we had a wonderful consensus of people. We had the chairman of several major banks, and we have a list someplace in our archives.
Well, we've had chairmen with a much longer tenure. Chairman Breeden, for example, with his near 8 years, and Chairman Leather with his near 8 years. But in your 2 year tenure, I don't think that there's anybody who's yet equal the number of initiatives that have endured as those that you initiated while you were there.
It's like riding the circuit. If the circuit's up, you ride the board.
And it is, as we proceed here, I want to make sure that in going over my agenda, I've not left out any of the initiatives that you would regard as important during your tenure there that we should be also talking about.
You did three things I hope you recall. When I got there, I was appalled by the state of the files. And we hired a fellow named Peter Shipman to come in and try to computerize the commission. I had this marvelous notion that if the commission had been computerized, they would have caught equity funding much earlier because there had been a disconnect between the profits they were making and the number of insurance policies they were selling. And the idea was that we could somehow pull the information together and the enforcement division could automatically see from the data where they should investigate. And so I think we began the computerization of SEC in those days. I can't put together what happened after Peter left and how we got to Edgar, but I don't think there was any concerted effort before I was there to do that. You may recall that we began an affirmative action program, a program to find out where women and the minorities were in the commission. I can't remember the person who put in charge of that. And I think we formalized the international operations in those days.
you may recall that near the end of our tenure, we had a big trip planned to Europe. It was going to be a grand trip. We were going to deal with things. Richard Breed and I know, really, many, many years later, really brought the international aspects to the Commission. But you may recall we had trips planned to all the exchanges in Europe. And then I forget what happened at the last minute that we canceled the trip. But it was, I have some hopes that we left a couple of ideas there that's probably.
I still am blanking out of the name of your affirmative action director, who was the first in the commission's history. His first name was Phil, and perhaps his last name will come to me in a moment. Remarkably, I saw him just last week at the Kennedy Center, where he is enjoying productions and helping to run the Kennedy Center's opera house. But his name may come to me a bit later as well. Were there any other initiatives that we should be talking about that you take some pride in?
Do you remember that we tried to keep track of enforcement? We tried to have a computer logging so that the day the enforcement action began, the first time that a company knew that it was under investigation was logged, so that we would come back to it and we wouldn't let things lag. I think maybe that stayed on. The other thing I remember, which I remember with great pleasure, is that the administrative cases were lagging sometimes 2 and 3 years. And I forget what we pulled it down to, but you and I really worked at getting the judges, getting those things on the docket, getting them out, and getting the decisions. I think we got it down to something like 6 months, whereas they've been lagging for 2 or 3 years. Much of respect for government is just having it work efficiently, and I think we did something. You may recall that.
I think you're on.
Is it joining? It is joining, so.
All right.
Turn that down.
Okay.
Okay,
Rod, I think what we were, thank you very much. I think what we were doing was just getting ready for you to tell us a bit about how government efficiency was enhanced and fostered by a part of a meeting that you had with President Ford.
Let me call together a group of the regulatory agencies, which had started, by the way, when we had this regulatory reform in the White House. During my tenure as counsel to the President, I was chairman of the White House Council on Regulatory Reform, so it was really a reprise of a meeting that we had in the East Room of the White House before I left the White House. And we were able to say a lot of things about what we've done at the Commission. One of the important things, of course, was the fact that we had improved the efficiency. Do you remember the Order of the Turtle?
I do.
During the session in the White House, Paul McAvoy, who was my co-chairman and member of the Council of Economic Advisors, we kind of helped the President. He talked to the head of all these agencies, and Mr. President Ford was really quite excited about the way in which all these agencies had responded to his call for regulatory reform and the fact that a large bipartisan number of senators and congresspeople had agreed to this effort in regulatory reform, economic reform. And as we walked back to the Oval Office, the President was saying how pleased he was with it, and Paul McAvoy had said to him as we went back, he said, "Oh, Mr. President, it was a good meeting." He said, "But you got to remember that a regulatory agency should be likened unto a turtle. If you put a small piece of lettuce in front of its nose, it'll quiver and move imperceptibly slightly faster. When you get all done, the damn thing's still a turtle. It's got a thick hide, it doesn't move very fast." And so when I came over to the Commission, you may recall that I asked all the other independent agencies if they would like to participate in the Order of the Turtle. And we found, I don't know if you found or I found, we found a glass ashtray in the form of a turtle. And the nice thing about this glass ashtray was that if you understand the habits of a turtle, you put it on its back, it can't do anything. And of course, an ashtray is no good unless you put it on its back, a turtle ashtray. And so the idea was that we would inscribe these turtles to any agency that achieved most regulatory reform. And I must say to you, with some sentimentality, that a few months ago I went to the funeral of John Robson, who was the chairman of the CAB. I haven't seen his wife in many, many years. He was then the head of the Export Import Bank. He'd just come on board in the new Bush administration. And John was John got the first ASHRAE because he had moved to CAV 4, and we gave him this ASHRAE, if you describe to John Robson, who has done more than anybody else to put the turtle on his back. And at the services, we were sitting behind his widow, and she turned around and she said, you know, we still have that ASHRAE. So the order or the turtle did not last very long, but I must say that President Carter was very good about it. I can't think of the name of the turtle right now that was in his White House staff, but for many months thereafter, he invited me to come over and talk about what we had done in revenue reform generally. And I'll take some credit, but I would say President Ford and Alan Greenspan get a whole lot of credit for understanding that economic deregulation as much as economic regulatory reform in the form of economic regulation was important. And we did a lot at the SEC, and we did a lot, company firm did a lot, the firm, the corporation, the government did a lot in transportation generally and financial services.
As a footnote, I just recall that your affirmative action director was a fellow named Phil Savage, and he was the first in the commission's history to I recall.
There was a person of Japanese ancestry that did the national.
I don't recall that. The world will, of course, be interested in kind of a general, let's say, overview of what you've done since you left the SEC and what you're doing today.
You decide to get into trouble? Much of my life is spent with the emerging economies, with investments and troubled economies, and troubleshooting investments. But in these years, I served on something like 17 boards, 15 since I left the commission. I've been chairman of 10 audit committees. I participated, sadly, in the discharge of, I guess, 9 chief executive officers. For the most part, satisfactorily reformed those boards. And taught a bit. I spent nearly a year as a sabbatical teaching at Yale. And probably the thing I'm most pleased with is this foundation my wife and I started a year and a half ago called the Fund for the Study of Corruption, or the Study of Governance, depending upon what part of the world you're in. And it's a major effort. As I mentioned to you before we began this recording, CSIS has asked that I bring what is now called the Hills Governance Program.
And the CSIS is what?
CSIS, the Center for the Strategic International Studies. Sam Nunn is its chairman. John Hammer, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense, is its president. And we have research centers that we're supporting in Russia and Ukraine right now. We're about to put 5 research centers in Southeast Asia, 5 cities in Manila, Kuala Lumpur, Bangkok, Singapore, and Jakarta. That's an important thing. We're really trying to teach governance, understand the costs of misgovernance. So that's a good part of my life right now.
You know, Rod, again, since we're recording history here, and since you are a contemporary of our still current chairman, Harvey Dick, I think it would be unfair to those who read this transcript to not ask you your views on the turmoil that Harvey has faced over the course of the past year as the commission's chairman, and your view of the way the world has regarded the agency under his tenure.
Well, I have to take a slightly broader slice of history. I don't know how many years I would go back, but for some time, the commission has been understaffed. Individuals are not, the commission has not been able to keep the quality of people it needs to keep. And so almost everybody that came after, whatever that period was, when the commission became really kind of ragged, if you will, not being able to, in a conscious way, to decide which of the things, which of the problems of corporate governance they should deal with. And Harvey came into that, environment. I guess I would give you some platitudes. There's been a lot wrong with accounting for a long time. Way back when Sandy Burton was our chief accountant, we knew then that we weren't addressing the intellectual problems of accounting as we should.
I was candidly disappointed that my successors did not give the chief accountant's job the dignity and the distinction they should have. I thought there was you should seek much better people, much broader people, not better people. And so the accounting profession suffered through the years. And in that environment, we had the collapse of a bubble. I happened to live through the bubble of 1969, the bad bubble then. There was another bubble in the 80s. And at the end of every bubble, you find terrific irregularities in corporate governance. And if you look carefully, accounting problems were part of all of it. The conglomerate craze of the late 60s, you had terrible accounting problems. As I mentioned, Republic, we had problems. So Harvey came into a period where his predecessor, Chairman Leavitt, sensed something really wrong with accounting. And was right in highlighting it. But I think it was too narrow a focus. He was focusing on the accounting profession, not on the problem. I've always thought that the accounting profession was caught in a system they couldn't change. And that means they're not to blame. They're not blameless, but they don't get the whole blame. And so in comes Harvey, who had been representing the accounting industry and saw nothing but the accounting profession saw as oppression. They saw only that they'd been unfairly singled out. And so I think Harvey came in focusing on trying to relieve the pressure in the accounting industry and didn't focus enough about the fact that there's a serious accounting problem, not just the accounting industry. And we did not react to the broader need, did not see the broader need. And all of a sudden he was caught up into all these facts. So the SEC had not, for example, had the capacity for many, many years to look at the financial statements of companies. Now, would they have caught Enron if they had been reading the Enron statements year after year after year? I can't say they would. But they might have caught a lot more. They might have seen this problem earlier. Accounting in simple facts over the years has become a commodity. The annual report has no added value in the minds of most CEOs. The accountant is somebody you hire on the basis of who charges the last piece of money. And in that environment, how do you deal with it? Arthur dealt with it in a public relations fashion quite well, and I think it was quite correct to bring attention to it. He's not focusing on the fact that accountants have become a bunch of rule checkers. They didn't become rule checkers the day Harvey became the chairman, the day Arthur became the chairman. And so you had this static condition that had to be changed, and the accounting industry couldn't change that. So still can't. And so, sadly, Harvey was unable to deal with it in a public relations fashion. He certainly had all the capacity in the world. He certainly had the integrity to deal with it. But I guess you'd have to say he didn't have the personality to deal with it. And that's the sad part of it. But again, it can't all be blamed on Harvey, and I'm certainly not trying to blame Arthur for anything. I'm simply saying you had a buildup over all those years of a failure in the accounting profession. When I finished the SEC in 1977, you may recall Russ Palmer was the head of Two Trusts. Russ and I have done a lot of things together. That year, Russ became the chairman of the Wharton School. And in those years, 23% of the graduates of Wharton, graduate school of business, went to the accounting profession. Comparable figures were true of Harvard, Chicago, Stanford, Michigan. Those people with that broad education don't go to the accounting profession. They're not there. We don't have those people out there in this global economy where we need them. And so it's that broad issue. Those people weren't there when this last bubble burst. And so the accounting problems that everybody is suffering right now are suffering from a system that is grown creepy. You know, the SEC is only here 7 years old. You may have heard me say anything 70 years old gets a little creepy. I can prove it. But the system itself is a problem. And Harvey, I'm not sure anybody could have done that. I feel deeply for Bill Donaldson, hope that he can do it. He can do it. But it's a very serious problem. A system that needed fixing, a commission did not have the economics, the support, the financial support to do what needed to be done, and a world economy and a business economy in the United States does not understand the problem.
Let me ask you, since we're on the topic of current topics, if you would reflect for us a bit on your views on this other maelstrom that surrounds the agency, and one of them, and a certain segment of the regulated community, investment advisors, and the claim that they have been pumping out investment advice to promote the corporate finance practices of their firms, while at the same time harboring deep doubts among themselves about the viability and profitability of the firms that they're recommending to the rest of us to buy.
It's sad that that problem's been there for so long, and we've got to go with it. It's a problem of transparency, of course. I mean, how many times, how many hundreds and hundreds of IPOs can come out and be tripled in value in 24 hours and not have somebody say, wasn't the pricing undervalued? When I was a kid, 1957, I remember coming to a law firm, and the firm I worked in, and we were working, the firm was working on some IPO, and I was told that since I was working on the case, I'd be getting some shares, I'd be allocated some shares. I didn't know what that meant. And a couple of days later, I understood it meant that I made several hundred dollars on this IPO, because they come out and double, and the broker automatically sold the shares. I was told that I'd been allocated shares. I wasn't asked if I'd have any money. A couple of days later, I was told that the shares I bought had been sold, and I got a check for a couple of $200. I hope Charlie Munger recalls this. Charlie was, as you may know, is a colleague of Warren Buffett now, but later Charlie and I, my wife started walking together. I went in to see Charlie, and I didn't understand this stuff. He said, my God, are they still doing that? He sent the check back. The idea that a young lawyer working on a financial statement for a public issue should be rewarded for having issued it out was just crazy. Now look how many years we tolerated that. All these years. The analysts. Well, you can't tell an analyst, you can't create a business by having the investment banking firms subsidize analysts. You've got to pay analysts what they're worth based upon the value of what they do. And it's transparency. I mean, I think that the idea of creating more transparency, I think the idea of saying you can't give incentives for an analyst for the investment banking work they do, I mean, those are terrific things. But there's no problem that we discovered this year that we didn't know 35, 40 years ago. The community never got to it. Now, why didn't we understand that well from you at the SEC? I can't answer the question. We didn't address it.
Now, you are a law professor and a policymaker and a regulator and a businessman, but you are also a lawyer at court. And the SEC has just announced new proposed rules that might, under some circumstances, require counsel to make a noisy withdrawal, blow the whistle on their clients. That rule is currently being considered by the SEC, and I'm curious what your reflections would be on the SEC's role mandating normative standards of professional conduct for lawyers.
Well, let me give you my thoughts. We've come a wonderfully long way from the day in which a lawyer was hired by the company would never consider, even long distance, going to the board of directors of the company to say something was wrong with the way the company was doing business. And if you go back to when I started practicing law, the idea that if you're hired by the company, you're hired by management, you don't represent the board. I mean, and theoretically, you represent the shareholders, and a good lawyer would quit before he would allow the company to make anything profit. But with the advent of audit committees and all the rest, I think it's fair to say that a significant majority of the better law firms would automatically bring something to the attention of the board of directors that they hadn't brought before. But I must say to you that, having said that, I would say today that many law firms are deficient. They look to the CEO of a company or the general counsel of a company for their fees, and they would not easily insist that some problem go to the board of directors. That, to me, is the big hurdle, to say unequivocally to the lawyers today, as we said to the accountants back in 1976, if you see something suspicious, you've got to go to the independent audit committee. And to say now to the lawyers unequivocally, you cannot suffer something to be incorrect without making sure the board sees it. The next step is really hard, because we do honor the tradition of attorney-client privilege.
you've got to recognize that the real clients of the director are not the board. The real clients are the shareholders.
The real clients are the lawyers.
They're the lawyers, they're the shareholders. And if the board is obtuse, if he says that this is wrong, and the board doesn't react on it, I don't like the idea of a noisy withdrawal, because that is picking up the phone and calling the agency and say, I can't tell you what it is, guys, but there's something wrong over there. Go look. I don't like that. But I don't like the alternative of having the lawyer say, okay, I told the board I'm done with it. I don't have an answer for it. It's a phenomenon. I think is a practical answer. Each lawyer who faces that kind of problem can figure out a way to deal with it. There is a large shareholder. There's a large fund manager. There's some way in which he can communicate to somebody. There's somebody on that board that will worry more than the other directors about that problem. He can make sure that somebody continues that problem if he leaves. So the noisy withdrawal, to me, is not the solution. And to me, the greatest thing here is to make sure that the lawyers in this world recognize they do not work for the CEO. They work for at least the board of directors. And through the board of directors, they work for the shareholders.
Well, President Bush 43 has now nominated William Donaldson to be the next chairman of the SEC. His confirmation hearings have yet to be scheduled, but I expect that they will be soon and he will be confirmed. And hopefully, when his agenda quiets down, he'll have an opportunity to perhaps review the pace of these interviews with past commission officials and commissioners to get some insight about what he's to be doing. And perhaps you might share with us what you would be telling Bill Donaldson about what you think his first act should be at the SEC when confirmed.
You may recall that you and I met with him not so long ago as part of this new American Assembly that we're doing in a future accounting profession, as Palmer being our co-chairman. Bill's on it. You were graciously, and two other former general counsel, Sylon and Jim Doty, agreed to help us organize this American Assembly. And I think it's interesting that Bill is genuinely interested in the future of the accounting profession and approaches it with an open mind. I guess I would say to him that the important thing right now is to help define again the role of the SEC, establish its priorities. I think in doing that, probably lower its profile so they can get on with this business. It's a hard business. It's not just the accounting profession. It's the investment management business. It's the stockbroking business. It's the global economy business. Kind of roll up his sleeves and get to work. I don't think any grand pronouncements to be made. We've created this kind of oversight board. It's kind of unique. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't know that the kind of oversight board has been given any authority. The SEC has not always had. The only difference is they have more money. They've been given control over the budget subject only to the SEC. We have this unique circumstance where the SEC does not have enough money, but they can authorize the money in this thing called the kind of oversight board. Rationalizing that will be a challenge. I think it's unique that this is happening, and if you look at it again from the focus of history, in 1934, the commission had to decide what they would do with the 34 Act, and they decided to use the self-regulatory process a lot. And now the Accounting Oversight Board is going to have to make the same decision all over again. And Bill. He has some influence over that. I wish him well. I will say again, however, that the capacity of the SEC depends upon the guideposts that are used for corporate finance, for corporate governance, if you will. And that depends upon some reliable standards. And I come back almost always to the fact that we have an accounting industry in disarray. We have accounting standards in disarray. We have different ideas about it. And I would say that if Bill Donaldson can do one thing, he can pull the commission, he can work with the global community, he can work with people like Sir David Tweedy of the National Accounting Standards Board, to find a way to develop a universal set of standards, and more importantly, a universal enforcement standard. I mean, we have the problem that we have a far better enforcement mechanism in this country than we do in the rest of the world. to rationalizing the accounting standards and enforcement techniques, and doing it in an efficient fashion over the next year or two will be a great challenge.
Well, Rod, on behalf of the Historical Society, I want to thank you for taking the time that you've taken with us today. Clearly, you are the Dean Emeritus of the former chairman of the SEC, certainly one of the most distinguished chairmen in the Commission's history. Be it far from me to try to summarize what we've done in this past hour, but clearly you presided over the Commission at a time of transition, where the Commission regained the agenda of the agency. You were the really founder of the Commission's efforts to reform corporate governance, an effort that goes on today. You were instrumental in creating the Commission's voluntary disclosure program to root out corporate corruption and give that more transparency, and thereby raise the normative standards of conduct for corporations across the world. You brought computerized record keeping to the SEC, which is really the forerunner of our EDGAR system today. Affirmative action was something that was on your agenda, brought it to the SEC, and hopefully the SEC has learned and lived within the policy judgments you made at the time. Regulatory reform, you began your tenure with at the White House and continued the distinction to the SEC. So again, we're most appreciative of what you've had to share with us today. I want to particularly note our thanks for your reflections on former Chairman Garrett, who's no longer with us, and your recollections and insights about some of the aspects of Chairman Garrett's tenure that you've recited here today. It may be the only record of those things that will endure. So thank you very much.
Hey, Clint, kind of occurs to me as you're talking. When I finished my testimony after the Sarbanes Committee, one of the staff members came up and asked me a little bit about myself. He said, "No, you're the oldest living chairman that we want to talk to."
All right. Thank you, Rod.
Thank you.